Mike Malloy here. Welcome to Monday night's program. If you email me and don't get an answer, it's because my email has been hijacked. So it'll probably take a couple of days to get it straightened out again. So I can still read what you send me, but I just can't respond. This is the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. As you know, I'm sure everybody has been talking about it. You know, I've been listening to all the commentary about it, all the historical significance, and so on and so forth. And I truly believe that most of the American commentators have everything wrong as to the circumstances that brought the wall down. As a matter of fact, the one of the points of view I heard today, not point of view, but one of the historical aspects of this, oddly, Tom Brokaw, 20 years ago, he had an interview with Honecker, who was at the time, the East German president or whatever, prime minister, president. And in the course of that interview, Honecker said, and it was broadcast on German television, I believe, that people would be allowed to pass from East Germany to West Germany. And within hours, people started doing just that. Thousands showed up. Well, that was kind of the end of it. Once they started passing through the wall, it was only a matter of time before people decided that the wall was pointless. Now, that is just one little anecdote. The reasons behind the Berlin Wall coming down, of course, are many and varied. And it would take an historian who is not biased in favor of the United States to really present to the American people the reason all of this happened, and who wasn't a Republican. The Republicans would tell you it was because the half-senile Ronald Reagan stood there and said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." You know, that kind of nonsense. But anyway, 20 years ago, it's also another anniversary. It was it 70 years ago, 71 years ago? Is it 71 years? Could it be that long? Yeah. 71 years ago tonight was Germany was Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass. It was on the evening of November 9th through November 10th, 1938, in a coordinated attack on Jewish people and their property. There were close to 500 Jews were murdered, according to historical accounts. It may have been a lot more than that. And as many as 50,000 were arrested and placed in concentration camps. Almost 1,000 synagogues were destroyed that night. Thousands of homes and businesses were ransacked. Now, this is all done by the Hitler Youth, the Gestapo, the SS, and the SA. The SA, of course, would be the equivalent of the teabaggers in this country. Kristallnacht also served as a means for the wholesale confiscation of firearms from German Jews. And there weren't that many. There were maybe 500,000 Jews in Germany at the time. But the similarities here, you know, this right-wing crazed fascist government of Hitler, you know, picked a target group and did this, took their guns, destroyed their homes, their places of worship, arrested them. This is what is very slowly we're moving towards that, I think, in this country. One of the thoughts I had today when I was listening to some of the commentary, I didn't want to listen to much of it about the Berlin Wall coming down, because as far as I'm concerned, most of the commentators just, it was just jingoistic horse crap about the triumph of capitalism and the defeat of communism, all this other nonsense. But, you know, it made me wonder how many walls have gone up in the past 20 years. Now, of course, we right away we think about the wall the Jews have built in Israel to keep the Muslims out who live in Palestine, keep them out of Israel, Israeli territory, territory they claim to be theirs. But how many other walls have gone up? When you think about all the prisons built in this country for in the past 20 years by the prison industrial complex, extraordinary number of walls have gone up in the past 20 years. So just me thinking about this today. You know, I'm on my walk and I'm thinking about this and I'm walking through the woods. Well, it's through a wooded area. I mean, I've got a path I walk on. And I'm swinging these 3-pound weights, one in each hand. Well, you think that's lightweight? Try it. But I'm thinking to myself about all the stuff I'd heard today about, and over the weekend about, 20th anniversary of the wall coming down. What wall? Oh, the Berlin Wall. How many walls have gone up here? How many people have been, slammed into prisons and jails and, institutions here in this country? How many people around the planet now have had walls go up, figurative and literal, in the 20 years since this date, 1989? How many walls have gone up? And what is it about the breaking down of the Berlin Wall that is so fascinating, so emotional, so, you know, unless you were a German. I mean, if you were German, well, yeah. I mean, your city had been more or less cut in half by the Allies. And then this wall goes up and, you know, I mean, I don't know. And I couldn't come up with the answers. Like a lot of the stuff I think about, I don't get any answers. You know, I wish I were smart like Limbaugh or Beck or Hannity. So I, you know, I could just sit here and go, oh yeah, okay, well, that's right. But you know, I couldn't come up with any answer, on any of that. I it was just like a thought problem. You know, how many walls have gone up since the Berlin Wall has come down? And how many people have found themselves placed behind these walls in the 20 years? And why, you know, I wonder if the people in the former Soviet client states, I wonder how they feel about their new masters. You know, the old masters were these communist bastards. The new masters are the capitalist bastards. And I just wonder, you know, I wonder. I'm not there. I'm not them. So, you know, I don't know. I know that a lot in the Baltics, particularly Latvia, is about to disappear. And they were considered the, the most phenomenal capitalist business centers, financial, everything was just wonderful, and now everything is about to be consumed into the fires of debt and capitalism. So, I just wonder. That's all. The Berlin Wall and Kristallnacht. All the, and the sad part about, come on, Malloy. Many sad parts. But one of the low-key sad parts to me, you know, a country that produced Bach and Beethoven and Pachelbel and Mendelssohn and, you know, you just go on and on and on. You know, 71 years ago, they decided to start murdering people, rounding people up, destroying synagogues. Oh, they had a reason. Yeah, they said the reason was the German diplomat Ernst von Roth was assassinated by a German Jew, a German-born Polish Jew. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. It is 21 past the hour. Regarding Reagan's role in the wall coming down, Bruce writes, Reagan's speechwriters felt confident in issuing that wall challenge. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall! Because they knew that was exactly what Gorbachev was going to do. The CIA had been predicting that the Russians would have no choice but to abandon Europe. They could no longer pump enough oil. The Red Army was using its bases to grow its own food. The ruble was worthless. Gorbachev had been talking to Reagan, or rather his handlers, at length. Reagan merely raised his staff and commanded the sun to rise. Right, of course. Of course. Oh, my God. I don't know if you know this. The teabag atrocity at the Capitol, when was it? Last week, where the American white Christian moron carried the picture of a pile of dead Jews from Dachau, and the caption on the placard said "National Socialist Healthcare, Dachau, Germany, 1944." That whole thing was bankrolled by a guy named David Koch, K-O-C-H, David Koch, Koch or Koch, I think it's Koch, a billionaire behind Newt Gingrich's attack on Clinton all those years ago. He's also the founder of Americans for Prosperity, a neat-sounding little organization that works tirelessly to dismantle this republic. His son, Bobby Koch, is a lobbyist, and he has access to every member of Congress because he's married to George W. Bush's sister, Dorothy Bush. This was in the Financial Times of today. Senior Bush administration figures, including Zalmay Khalilzad, the former U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, and Jay Garner, the retired general who led the reconstruction efforts immediately after the invasion of Iraq, are leading a new business push into Iraq. The two one-time senior officials are among a raft of former U.S. diplomats, either leveraging their war experience helping foreign companies to enter the Iraqi market or starting businesses there themselves. Oh, no, really? Mr. Khalilzad's company, Khalilzad Associates, this year set up offices in Baghdad and the northern Kurdish city of Erbil, from which it is advising companies wanting to do business in Iraq. The company declined requests for interviews with the Financial Times, but a spokesperson confirmed the establishment of its offices and that Mr. Khalilzad, also former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., had made several trips to the country this year. Mr. Garner, the former general, the de facto U.S. governor of Iraq after the invasion, sat on the board of something called Bast Exploration when it bought 37% of a Kurdistan oil block 2 years ago and remains an advisor to the Canadian company. Oh, it's a Canadian company. Quote, Jay is very well known in Kurdistan and Iraq, and it was useful to the company, said a, unquote, said a spokesman for VAST. VAST, I guess that's the Canadian company. As security has improved, both the Iraqi and U.S. governments have stepped up efforts to promote closer business ties. And I like this line. But the move by former Bush administration officials is seen as controversial, especially as many in the Arab world remain convinced the main target of the 2003 invasion was to control the country's oil resources. The director of Revenue Watch Institute, a New York watchdog organization, said, quote, officials who move on to do business where they recently had significant political influence will raise public suspicion, even if nothing is actually wrong, end quote. No, Madam Director of the Revenue Watch Institute, won't raise any suspicions in this twisted country. Of course not. Why not go to Iraq and do business if you were the former occupation general in charge of everything, or if you were the former ambassador, or if you, and it's not just these two. There is a whole, what do you call a pack of rats? Not a herd. Other than Republicans, what do you call a whole bunch of rats? Look, you know, let's stop beating around the bush, okay? These people are some of these Americans, these capitalist Americans, are some of the filthiest, putrid people on earth. They really are. They would smash the heads of children in their stampede to steal whatever they get their goddamn hands on. Man. And they're out there promoting the image of America. We'll be right back.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malone.
26 before the hour. Thanks, everybody. Let me know that the KOCH family is pronounced Coke. KOCH is pronounced Coke. Buddy in Palm Beach was the first one through with that. And a pack of rats is called pack, swarm, horde, or a mischief of rats? Really? Thanks, Reg. Oh, my God. I don't know. Tyler in Richmond, Virginia writes, Mike, just wanted to share this little story with you today. This morning I heard an acquaintance of mine who openly and proudly proclaims her Christian faith talking about the health care bill that had just past the house. She was scoffing at the idea of paying taxes to help the poor and said maybe she should quit her job so that she may also receive, quote, free health care, end quote. When I pointed out to her, with some rather rude language, I admit, that poor people who can usually not afford health care actually are hardworking Americans who sometimes work more than one job and that this bill was to protect them, she accused me of exploiting her hard work for the benefit of others. Eventually, our back and forth landed on the topic of her religion. I reminded her that the Bible clearly states that the fortunate are to give their wealth to the poor and that it is virtually impossible for a person who hoards their wealth to enter the kingdom of heaven. Excuse me. To my surprise, this argument only hardened her stance, and she began to openly mock the Bible as out of date and, quote, subjective, end quote. To me, this is truly scary. When Christians begin to choose their right-wing ideology over the teachings of their religion, what hope is left for them? And, of course, what hope is left for us? I've always known Republican politicians use Christianity to gain votes. But to see it used, abused, and then neglected by someone I always thought of as a good Christian, well, that simply baffles me. Tyler in Richmond. Yeah, capitalism and Christianity are work together as well as open wounds and rock salt, or babies crawling on the ground in a pit of rattlesnakes. I mean, Christianity is no more about capitalism than any religion is about. This money-grubbing attitude. Most religions, and I have to give religions credit for that, most religions, somewhere within their canon of laws, there are requirements that the poor or the lame or the halt or the blind or those less fortunate than the adherent to this particular religion should be taken care of. And, you know, I mean, Jesus, the man, said that too. I mean, come on. Christianity is a dead religion. It is a religion that is dying because it has drifted so far from what the guy who tried to explain to people a better way to live 2,000 years ago was trying to say. So, whatever. I got this from Glenn, who doesn't live here, lives in the UK. Hello, Mike. Posted this on your message board today. Hope a foreigner's perspective could be of use, particularly since I have lived in the U.S. for the better part of a decade and got a good impression of your nightmare of a system which is so outrageous, yet meekly accepted as simply being a way of life. The post I put up at your website follows. As a British person, I'm amazed at all this. Even though I spent a number of years living in the U.S., we have free universal health care in the U.K. In Wales, which, like England and Scotland and Northern Ireland, is part of the U.K., we do not even pay a contribution toward prescription drugs. So if I need to see the doctor, I make an appointment, nearly always for the same day, 10-minute wait in the office, max as a rule, free consultation, no forms, nothing to sign. If I need drugs, the doctor writes a prescription, and I get them for free from the chemist next door, the pharmacy next door. Not a penny exchange, no waits, no paperwork. The speed and skills of paramedics and emergency workers are also incredible. If you have a complaint, it will be dealt with very seriously indeed. If all of this still isn't good enough for you, one can go private and utilize health insurance companies too. It baffles me why Americans shy away from our system. I cannot understand why they don't consider any of the following obvious points. Question: why don't British people demand the abolition of the National Health Service? Answer: because we're happy with it and wouldn't have it any other way. Question: why does every last UK politician speak so favorably of the National Health Service and their commitment to it? Answer: because it would be political suicide to threaten or diss the NHS in any way. Question: why do British and overseas doctors train long and hard to work for the NHS? Answer: because it pays well and they're satisfied with their jobs. Nurses and ancillary staff are another story. Question: what are the biggest problems with the NHS? Answer: the partial privatization that started with Thatcher and has continued under so-called New Labour, the poor treatment and pay of nurses, and the farming out of much of the unskilled work to private companies, and excessive use of so-called clipboard consultants, private-public partnerships, and internal markets within the NHS have been a disaster. This Thatcher legacy has been the poison pill of our current NHS, this partial Americanization, if you will. Question: what do the British people think of the right wing in America slagging off the British National Health Service? Answer: it makes us angry. All this talk, Lynn writes, about waiting lists, it being excessive, people dying without treatment, etc., is exaggeration, fueled hugely by the far-right gutter press, which bedevils the UK and is our national disgrace. But even they dare not knock the National Health Service as a concept, try as they might to claim it is bad and highlight lackings. Of course, the very best health care for the ultra-rich in the United States is better than that for the general National Health Service patient who would expect otherwise. But what sort of comparison is that? The rich can get private health care in the UK if they want it. And even then, remarkably few do so. What beats me most of all is why Americans are so ready to take the odd anecdote of failure abroad as proof that they can't do it themselves. What happened to the American can-do spirit? Heck, why don't Americans say, if the British and hell, even the Cubans can make that good a job of free universal health care, we, by God, are going to make a magnificent job of it. Good luck on this one, America. You need it. Glenn. I don't know. I'm sure Glenn understands that the United States has become, in so many aspects, an asylum that is populated with inmates who are in various stages crazy. Our political system is utter madness. The people who are hollowing out that system, the members of the Senate and the House, most of them, there are a couple of good ones left, are nothing but paid whores, excuse me, no offense to sex workers, for various corporations, massive corporations, too big to fail corporations in this country, whether they are pharmaceutical, medical, military, telecommunications, energy, you know the drill. Come on. This is nothing that a thinking American doesn't understand. So it is an asylum. But we have great cooking shows. Let me see here. What else we got? I have all kinds of stuff here. But Prairie 2 writes, gold hit a new high today as the dollar continued to decline. Long-term oil futures are hovering around $100. And inflation-protected instruments are big sellers. The stock market is up as well as the glut of cheap dollars is driving everything up. Boom times for Goldman Sachs. But the danger is building in an obscure class of investors called the carry trade. The carry trade, C-A-R-R-Y, the carry trade, is where investors will borrow currency in a country that has a cheap money policy and move it to a country that has risky but profitable investments. This can be done with any currency, and the difference doesn't need to be that great, since little real money is involved. It's all done on margin, you know, like 1929. For the past couple of decades, the Japanese yen has been the favored currency for this purpose. This was what caused the collapse of the company Long Term Capital Management back in 1998 and exposed the folly of deregulation. The big Wall Street banks chipped in billions to take this problem off of Clinton's hands, and in return, the last of the New Deal regulations of banks was done away with entirely. That was the Glass-Steagall Act. Since banks could take care of the financial services industry themselves, why should millions of taxpayer money be spent on regulation? Cheap yen has been replaced by the cheap dollar, so now everything priced in dollars has been inflating the bubble. Dollars are flowing like water into all markets worldwide, and it's going to be a problem. Countries like Brazil, fearing the inevitable collapse, are restricting capital inflow, and others like India and China are buying gold. As the dollar continues to weaken from this illicit activity, it creates its own pressures for a reversal. Since there is no real restrictions on debt being used for leverage investment, the reversal creates a stampede to sell in order to cover margin calls, since the market bubble is being financed with debt on margin. The ensuing panic drives people into dollars, making the non-dollar investments worth even less, triggering more margin calls and creating a spiral of credit defaults. We'll be right back.
The Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
10 before the hour, finishing up Grade 2's missive. Nobody knows how much carry trade there is. That's the taking cheap dollars and taking them somewhere else. But it is a huge bubble, and it really can't be reversed once started. It will grow until it bursts. Since it's based on trillions of dollars in debt, it will drag everything down with it. This risk is spread across all types of investment, will destroy an unprecedented amount of paper wealth, and will surge across the real economy as well. This is, of course, bad news for your 401k, 301k, 201k, 101k, until finally, 001k. Unfortunately, past 30 years of Reaganomics has embedded the financial services industry into all aspects of the economy. Last year's credit freeze is just a taste of what is likely to happen. We will get change, whether we can believe in it or not. Prairie 2. Go to his website, prairienumeral2.com. Jesus, God, you know, this guy just scares the living hell out of me, right? I'll tell you, somebody else who scares the living hell out of me is Paul Krugman. He's talking about last Thursday's rally in his column today outside the U.S. Capitol to protest the health care legislation, featuring the kinds of things we've grown accustomed to, including that large sign showing piles of bodies at Dachau with the caption, National Socialist Healthcare. Krugman writes, quote, "It was grotesque, and it was also ominous. For what we may be seeing is America starting to be Californified." What? Californified. Anyway, he goes on. He said the important thing to understand about that rally is it wasn't a fringe event. It was sponsored by the House Republican leadership. In fact, it was officially billed as a GOP press conference. Senior lawmakers were in attendance, apparently had no problem with the tone of the proceedings. I think Eric Cantor, who is Jewish, the second-ranking House Republican, said the signs were inappropriate. And Eric Cantor's spokesman said the use of the Hitler comparisons by such people as Rush Limbaugh, quote, conjures up images that frankly are not, I think, very helpful, end quote. This from a Jew. This from a Jew. This is astonishing. It's astonishing. Apparently, once you become a Republican, whether you're a Catholic, a Jew, a Protestant, a Baptist, it doesn't make any difference. All of a sudden, whatever you used to believe in as off the table for use as criticism against the opposing party no longer exists. You can use pictures of heaps of grotesquely distorted, emaciated bodies from Dachau, and you can be a Jew and say, oh, well, yeah, well, that's probably a little bit bad, but, you know. What's next? Will the Catholics who exist inside the fundamentalist right in this country, the neo-Nazi right, will they have pictures of non-believers having their eyes gouged out and their testicles cut off from the Inquisition and say, well, you know, this is okay. So the caption said Obama's health care plan, surgery, no anesthetic. What are they going to say? What are the Catholics going to say? Oh, well, okay. It's a little bit out there, but, you know, it makes a point. What are the Christians going to say? Not the Christians, but the Protestants. What are they going to do? Are they going to show pictures of slavery and genocide that was perpetrated against Native Americans and perpetrated against Africans? Are they going to show these dead Native Americans from typhus infested blankets and stuff and just say, well, okay, you know, under a caption that says medical care under Barack Obama, you know, a pile of dead Native Americans and typhus germs all around. And, oh, well, all right, you know. What happens to people once they become absorbed or conversely absorb this right-wing crazy ideology? I keep going back to Germany. I'm sorry, I don't have a better example. And you look at the nation of Germany that produced some of the greatest thinkers of, I don't know, the past 500 years. The best composers, artists, and yet, out of that phenomenally intelligent, coherent society, Nazism was born. what happens to people when they adopt this right-wing ideology, whether they're German or American or Spanish or Italian or Japanese or whatever. What happens? In order to be a right-winger, in order to be a fascist or a corporatist, you have to give up everything, don't you? Every single aspect that might be identified as soul or consciousness or independent thought. Look at the people who follow Beck and Limbaugh. Look at them. I mean, we saw them all summer. Look at them in these meetings. Look at them in these demonstrations, this teabagger nonsense. Look at them. And you see these people, and I don't know, let me change the pronoun. I see these people, and I just wonder, how did I wind up in the same society with these monsters? And they're monsters because there's nothing there. I mean, they're being cattle prodded this way and cattle prodded that way. And it's just like, oh my God, I thought I lived in a country that, Oh boy. Bach, Beethoven, Paco Bell, Mendelssohn. And on and on and on. Do a Google or Wikipedia or something on German, classical German composers. And do anything. Classical German poets. Classical German writers. Classical German theater, dance, music. I mean, when you get right down to it, Germany, woo! They have produced some of the most incredibly civilized aspects of the human family in the history of the human family. And yet, Nazism took over their minds. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Thanks to you, you. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. What's this? I got an email from somebody who says they just started listening. Okay. I'll get to that in a minute. What was the... I can't answer email tonight, so my email, Addy, has been hijacked. We'll get it back, but it's going to require going through AOL. I know it. Yeah, the Stupak Amendment today, you all know about that, I'm sure. Oh, my God. I got an email here from Justine in Maryland, who writes, Mike, in a segment of Rachel Maddow's show tonight, it was revealed that the misogynist pigs on Capitol Hill who are pushing through amendments to prohibit coverage of women's health care, including privately paid for abortion services, are now proposing that women who want coverage for abortion purchase additional coverage. WTF? Let's see. For many women, Justine writes, contraception is not covered by the insurance vendor, but Viagra is. And many health insurance companies consider pregnancy, C-sections, and infants as pre-existing conditions and not only exclude women who might seek coverage for anything related to reproductive health, they're also now excluding, quote, expectant fathers, end quote. My proposal is to counter these disgusting and discriminatory practices by requiring all males to purchase a costly penis insurance, although she doesn't use the word penis. Penis insurance, writer, for anything related to the male genital urinary tract. Enough! Of course, we should have universal single-payer health care that covers everyone in all conditions. But I've stopped dreaming for now. Outrage more than usual, Justine in Maryland. Penis insurance. Back to Krugman. Krugman points out what all this craziness, like having a Jew as a second-ranking House Republican standing in front of a crowd that are referring to the President of the United States as a Nazi, and among the pictures waving in his face, a picture of the dead from Dachau, a huge pile of dead Jews, underneath naked, underneath the caption, or above the caption, National Socialist Healthcare, Dachau, Germany, 1945. And what does Harry Cantor say? Oh, well, this conjures up images that, frankly, are not, I think, very helpful. What a son of a bitch. What a cowardly bastard. And so it just raised the question for me, what happens to a person's religious beliefs when they become a right-winger? They get burned to the ground. I shared with you an email earlier tonight, the Christian woman who said, you know, the Bible was written under duress. I can believe whatever I want to, who considers herself a Christian. I don't know. Anyway, Krugman says what all this shows is that the Republican Party has been taken over by the people it used to exploit. Something snapped last year. Conservatives had long believed that history was on their side, so the GOP establishment could, in effect, urge hard-right activists to wait just a little longer. Once the party consolidated its hold on power, they get what they wanted. After the Democratic sweep, though, extremists could no longer be fobbed off with promises of future glory. Furthermore, the loss of both Congress and the White House left a power vacuum in a party accustomed to top-down management. At this point, Newt Gingrich is what passes for a sober, reasonable elder statesman of the Republican Party, and he has no authority. Republican voters ignored his call to support a relatively moderate electable candidate in New York's special congressional election last week. That would be the 23rd district in New York. Real power in the party rests instead with the likes of Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Sarah Palin. Because these people aren't actually interested in governing, they feed the base's frenzy instead of trying to curb or channel it. So all the old restraints are gone. And as Krugman is trying to point out, that's why, you know, these crazy sons of bitches, these right-wingers, these literally crazy people who have no problem with hoisting a photo of dead Jews from a death camp and relating that to Obama's policies, healthcare policies. It's astonishing. I used to hate these people. Now they just make me want to throw up. Krugman says in the short run, all this may help Democrats, as it did in that New York race. But maybe not. Elections aren't necessarily won by the candidate with the most rational argument. Yeah. He says, in fact, the party of Limbaugh and Beck could well make major gains in the midterm elections. The Obama administration's job creation efforts have fallen short, so the unemployment is likely to stay disastrously high through next year and beyond. The banker-friendly bailout of Wall Street has angered voters. It might even let Republicans claim the mantle of economic populism. You know, this is the thing I don't understand. The bailout of bankers started with Bush. You know, $1 trillion from Bush. Oh, did Obama follow through on it? Sure, of course he did. He's Republican light, but it was Bush. And when Bush did it, not a peep out of these rat bastards. Huh? Oh, well. Krugman says conservatives may not have better ideas, but voters might support them out of sheer frustration. And if Tea Party Republicans do win big next year, what has already happened in California could happen at the national level. In California, the GOP has essentially shrunk down to a rump party with no interest in actually governing. But that rump party remains big enough to prevent anyone else from dealing with the state's fiscal crisis. If this happens to America as a whole, as it all too easily could, the country could become effectively ungovernable in the midst of an ongoing economic disaster. The point is that the takeover of the Republican Party by the irrational right is no laughing matter. Something unprecedented is happening here, and it's very bad for America. Yeah, this is Krugman. This is the expected result, and I say expected. I think anyone with a modicum of sense about economic policy, foreign policy, domestic policy, and, you know, what made this country workable for a vast middle class could have seen back around 80, 81, 82, when unemployment was approaching 10.8% under Reagan, the national debt quadrupled under Reagan. Interest rates were in double digits under Reagan, that anyone could have seen what was being set up. What was being set up was the execution by strangulation of the middle class, the people who, you know, let's set aside all of our genocidal and racist and you know, murderous policies and global hegemony and all that other stuff. Let's try to scoop that off the table and just look at America. Look inside the country, United States, you know, for 50 years, 40 years, when the middle class was created, I mean, seriously created, a real middle class that stretched from coast to coast, border to border. And it was all done by Democrats, by liberals, by progressives. Republicans never contributed anything. Conservatives never contributed a goddamn thing to what this country has been about. But then I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened to liberals or progressives or Democrats. I guess they got sucked into the corporatist machine and started coming out as Republican light. And when Reagan came along and did all his damage, first with the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, nobody said anything. Right? It was just like Pastor Niemöller said. They came for this group, I didn't say anything. They came for that group, I didn't say anything. Finally, they came for me. Well, here we are now at the end of this Reagan cycle. 30 years, that's all it took to utterly, absolutely destroy the country.
The primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
It's 21 past the hour. I got an email from David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Dear sir, I've recently begun listening to you online. We know you can listen on the radio, David. I notice that you have some good points to make. There are two things, though, that I find to be distasteful or lacking. The first is the constant insults of those who are on the other side of the political spectrum. Insulting one's antagonist actually does not actually persuade anyone to agree with you. All right, there's more here. But David, look, I'm not trying to get anyone to agree with me out of your mind. As far as insulting people on the other side of the political spectrum, David, what do you call a mass killer? If you call him anything, you call him a rotten son of a bitch who killed a bunch of people. And that's what George Bush and most of the Republican parties do. What do you want from me? You know, don't send me smarmy little condescending emails like this. He also writes, the second point is that I did not find much in-depth defense of your philosophical positions or in-depth analysis of why your antagonists are incorrect. Oh, bite me. What the hell do you think you're listening to? NPR? Get out of town. Ah! This show's too tough for you. Go away, David. Listens online in a city where we have an affiliate on the radio. Oh, my God. Bruce writes, Joe Lieberman went on Fox Sunday and implied that he might have information through his office as chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, confirming last week's Fort Hood mass killer was an Islamic terrorist. This from the senator representing the health insurance terrorists who mass murder 1,000 people a week by denying care, and corporatized hospitals who, according to the AMA, murder another 2,000 people a week, largely from understaffing and poor management in order to maximize profits. The conservatives see this one suicidal madman as justification to kick all the Muslims out of the military, and that as the first step toward a general roundup. They ignore the fact that right-wing Christians have in total killed more people in the past year or so in the name of conservative Christian causes, and if they had not been stopped quickly, each of their murder sprees would have been much larger. And of course, it is a Christian who holds the record for domestic terrorism deaths. The Oklahoma City bomber, driven by so-called Christian values, had no problem planting his truck bomb in front of a daycare nursery in order to kill federal workers on the floors above. Remember that Timothy McVeigh was not clinically insane or suicidal and did not act alone. You would expect that Joe Lieberman would think twice about going on Fox and inciting the very people who would as likely commit mass murder to synagogue just as quick as a mosque or a liberal Christian church. Joe Lieberman is a rancid son of a bitch. He really is. I mean, the Democratic Party should just hang its head in shame. I mean, here is a guy who is slashing and burning from inside the Democratic Party, and they just let him continue. They just let him continue. Well, I mean, I don't know what to say about that. I just always want to just walk so far and so fast away from the Democratic Party. Rain writing at firedoglake.com on Saturday has a little quick blog. She talks about the betrayal of my support for Democrats. Now, the Stupak Amendment passed 240 to 194 with 64 Democrats voting yes. It's a fundamental part of our belief system in the Democratic Party that women have a right to privacy and their reproductive health care decisions. We've fought long and hard to protect this right. And now we've seen decades of work to protect this fundamental human right dashed by our own Democratic representatives. Many of you are going to say you're walking away from the Democratic Party, and many more are going to rant and rave and carry on for a while. This is when it's time to gather resources and plan more carefully for the next phase of in what is a lifelong effort. Democracy isn't easy, after all, and it's not cheap. We're going to have to continue to fight, but we're going to have to become even more effective. What say you? And the writer's talking about those 64 Democrats who voted yes on the Stupak Amendment. They should be removed from the Democratic Party, just like Joe Lieberman. I mean, you expect 30 Republicans to vote in favor of rape for women who have the temerity to go to a war zone, not as a combatant, but as a working for a private contractor. And if she gets raped, repeatedly if she is injured, grievously injured, physically, emotionally, and psychologically by repeated rape by members of a corporation for whom she works. And that corporation says, well, hey, you know, I mean, we handle this through arbitration. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You have 30 Republicans vote to continue the process of raping women with no recourse through the law. And then you have 64 Democrats who vote to deny a woman the right to privacy. And so why am I making such a big deal about Lieberman?
Right. From the left, it's more Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. I want you to listen to something. Thanks to Think Progress for this. This morning, this ties in perfectly with what Krugman was writing about the maniacs, the brown shirts now, the fringe, the crazed. And these are supposed to be adult, male, white Republicans that we're going to play for you. They've taken over the Congress. When you hear this, you're going to hear grown adult men, all white, all Republican, all in the U.S. House, trying to stop women, also white, Democrats in the House from stating their case why they believe that health insurance reform is a good idea. The way it started out, the House this morning began consideration of the rule for debate of the House health care bill, and the Democratic Women's Caucus took to the microphone in the House on the House floor to offer their arguments for how the bill would benefit women. And then this freak from Georgia, Tom Price, Republican representative from Georgia, Tom Price, and other Republicans, white males, repeatedly talked over, screamed, and shouted objections. I object, I object, I object, I object. Price just did it over and over as Representative Lewis Capps, a Democrat from California, tried to hold the floor. The Republicans continually talked over the Democratic women for half an hour. They sought to prevent the debate by calling for unnecessary so-called parliamentary inquiries and requests for, quote, expanding the debate by an hour. Among those repeatedly being interrupted by the Republican scum was Representative Mary Jo Kilroy, Democrat from Ohio, who observed, quote, do I not have the right to be able to continue my sentence without objections that are trying to censor my remarks here on the floor that I have a right to make as a member of this House? And John Dingell, the senile old bastard from Michigan, he's a Democrat and should have been removed, I don't know, 50 years ago. He tried to talk trash with, not trash, but he tried to assuage the Republican ruckus with, you know,
the debate must be conducted with a measure of comity and grace and decency. There's no advantage to be achieved by making all this fuss, he told the Republicans.
Listen to this. I'll play some of it for you. Just listen. This is the Republican Party, white adult males.
Mr. Speaker, I was just wondering if this was a stalling tactic by the majority party on delaying the vote on this important bill that will kill 5.5 million jobs today.
Chair, we'd hope the gentleman wouldn't object, but if he does, then it will be written on the record. The gentleman will state his objection here.
Object.
I intend
object.
To revise my
I
remarks
object.
In support of referral.
Gentlewoman,
Mr. Speaker,
from
parliamentary
health.
Inquiry.
Gentleman's out of order.
I must consent that my remarks
I object.
To revise my remarks
I object.
In support
object.
Of reform
I object.
That ensures that no
I object.
Mother will ever have her
I
child's
object.
Care denied
I
because
object.
Of a pre-existing condition.
I object.
Yep.
Mr. Speaker.
Chair wants
can you hold
chair
it? Can you stop him for just a second? Stop for just a second. Do you hear this son of a bitch? Do you hear these people? This particular son of a bitch is Tom Price. There's a member of Congress trying to make her point. She's not advocating anything. She's not entering an amendment. She's not trying to get a vote. She's just trying to state her case as part of the Women's Caucus. And this twit, this rat bastard in the background, repeating over and over, is a piece of white filth from Georgia, who is also representative. Go ahead, pick it up.
Colleagues, we're going to try and have a fair and orderly debate. The chair is going to remind my colleagues that every member has a right to place a unanimous consent request before the House.
All right. That's John Dingell. Listen to this moron trying to talk to these Republicans as though they're human. Now, I'm being very caustic and critical and nasty and name-calling about John Dingell. You're damn right. I don't care if he's a Democrat. He's a punk. So here he is trying to, play grab-ass with the Republican men. And Dingell, I guess, is so far into early-stage Alzheimer's or whatever the hell he's into, he doesn't realize that these white male Republicans aren't listening to a word he's saying. They don't give a damn. They're just waiting for the women to start talking again, and then they're going to try to shout them down.
Protect that right for the majority, and the chair is going to protect that right for the minority.
Yes.
And if delay occurs...
Yes.
This moment, it appears to the chair, that the delay occurs less on the chair's right than it does on the chair's left.
What?
The chair will observe that if the gentleman is concerned about speeding the business of the House, the business of the House can best be speeded by allowing the unanimous consent requests to be made.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I ask unanimous consent.
Mr. Speaker, reserving the right to object.
Gentleman will state his reservation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I have reserved the right to object. Am I allowed to be heard under that reservation at this juncture?
The chair regrets cannot be done.
Now remember what's going on
what
here.
What is happening?
What's going on here? Every male voice you hear is a white man, Republican, trying to stop women, members of Congress in the Women's Congressional Caucus, from just stating their case.
For my dear friends, is we're getting ourselves into an unnecessarily deep parliamentary morass. If my colleagues on the chair's left would withhold these objections,
Mr. Speaker,
we would not be in this snarl at this time.
Parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
Is out of order. The chair recognizes now again the gentlewoman from New York who controls the time at this moment.
I ask unanimous consent to revise
object.
And extend my remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Mr. Speaker, I object.
Mr. Speaker, parliamentary
objection.
Inquiry. Do I not have the right to be able to continue
objection.
My sentence without objections that are trying to
objection.
Censor my remarks here on the floor that I have a right to make as a
objection
member of this House.
Objection is heard.
I ask unanimous consent again to revise and extend my remarks because...
Object.
Objection is heard.
I'd ask to be heard. Mr. Speaker, the Republicans are asking for an extension of an hour on both sides under the rule equally allow
make
both sides
order,
30 additional minutes to be heard, because it's obvious that members of Congress need to be heard. And this rule.
You hear this? Do you hear this? This is, what Krugman wrote this morning. This is the teabaggers. These are the neo-Nazis. These are the corporatists who now own what's left of this filthy, stinking Republican Party. And keep in mind what you're hearing. White males, mostly from the South, who are refusing to allow women members of Congress to speak. That's what they're doing.
Order.
Does not provide the amount of time necessary, and the people who are here is an example of why this
order.
Is wrong.
makes access Speaker, to preventive
Speaker,
services
object.
Unaffordable. As a mother of four and a grandmother of three,
objection,
I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Mr. Speaker, because the Democratic bill gives women more opportunities to enter the medical profession and the modern health care workforce,
objection.
I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend.
Now, you have one female Republican. You hear her trying to shout down a female Democrat.
My remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Because it's time to protect older women by closing the donut hole, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
If members on one side of the aisle want their right protected, the chair observes that they should then respect the rights of members on the other side of the aisle. It will be the purpose of the chair to try and see that all members are heard at a proper time and fashion and to see that the rules are carried out. The chair will also try to see that the debate is conducted with a measure of comity and grace and decency. And the chair would request my friends on both sides of the aisle to respect that.
Inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
Chair,
could we make a unanimous consent request to expand the debate?
And it continues and continues. All right, let's go back to it. And hear the women in the Democratic Women's Caucus trying again.
It's been a long time here on this particular wrangle, or we can allow the proceedings to go forward, and everybody will have a chance to be heard as long as the chair is presided over by this particular member.
Yes, sir.
And the chair just requests my friends on the minority side, let's let the discussion go forward. It isn't hurting anything. And there's no advantage to be achieved by making all of this fuss.
Parliament.
Isn't that a nice crew? Oh, and Dingell, of course, spent 40 years opposing any regulation on the auto industry that might have to do with emissions or anything, right? John Dingell probably helped single-handedly to kill the state of Michigan. And there he is talking about,
oh, let's everybody play nice now. My friend's on the right and my friend's on the left. I'll bring you all together here so we can have this nice discussion. We'll sit back and talk about it.
And quoting from the Bible.
Nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. I'm still kind of freaked by what I just heard. I don't know how. Jesus, can't talk. Just kind of stunned. How could we have gotten to the point? Well, just remember Germany, one of the greatest cultural societies on the face of the earth. And look what happened to them. Man. Dennis Kucinich issued a public statement as to why he voted no on the so-called Affordable Health Care for America Act. He was one of the Democrats who voted against it. H.R. 3962. I'll start it and finish it on the other side of the break. He released this statement, why I voted no. We have been led to believe that we must make our health care choices only within the current structure of a predatory for-profit insurance system which makes money not providing health care. We cannot fault the insurance companies for being what they are, but we can fault legislation in which the government incentivizes the perpetuation, indeed the strengthening, of the for-profit health insurance industry, the very source of the problem. When health insurance companies deny care or raise premiums, copays, and deductibles, they are simply trying to make a profit. That's our system. Clearly, the insurance companies are the problem, not the solution. They're driving up the cost of health care. Because their massive bureaucracy avoids paying bills so effectively, they force hospitals and doctors to hire their own bureaucracy to fight the insurance companies to avoid getting stuck with an unfair share of the bills. The result is that since 1970, the number of physicians has increased by less than 200%, while the number of administrators has increased by 3,000%. It is no wonder that 31 cents of every healthcare dollar goes to administrative costs, not toward providing care. Even those with insurance are at risk. The single biggest cause of bankruptcies in the U.S. is health insurance policies that do not cover you when you get sick. But instead of working toward the elimination of for-profit insurance, H.R. 3962 would put the government in the role of accelerating the privatization of healthcare. In H.R. 3962, the government is required at least 21 million Americans to buy private health insurance from the very industry that causes costs to be so high, which will result in at least $70 billion in new annual revenue, much of which is coming from taxpayers. This inevitably will lead to even more costs, more subsidies, and higher profits for insurance companies, a bailout under a Blue Cross. By incurring only a new requirement to cover pre-existing conditions, a weakened public option, and a few other important but limited concessions, the health insurance companies are getting quite a deal. The Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, states, quote, since the president signaled that he is backing away from the public option, health insurance stocks have been on the rise, end quote. Similarly, healthcare stocks rallied when Senator Max Baucus introduced a bill without a public option. Bloomberg reports that Curtis Lane, a prominent health industry investor, predicted a few weeks ago that, quote, money will start flowing in again, end quote, to health insurance stocks after passage of this legislation. Investors.com last month reported that pharmacy benefit managers' share prices are hitting all-time highs, with the only industry worry that the administration would reverse its decision not to negotiate Medicare Part D drug prices, leaving in place a Bush administration policy. During the debate, when the interests of insurance companies would have been effectively challenged, that challenge was turned back. The so-called robust public option, which would have offered a modicum of competition to a monopolistic industry, was whittled down from an initial potential enrollment of 129 million Americans to 6 million. An amendment which would have protected the rights of states to pursue a single-payer health care was stripped from the bill at the request of the administration. Looking ahead, we cringe at the prospect of even greater favors for insurance companies. Recent rises in unemployment indicate a widening separation between the finance economy and the real economy. The finance economy considers the health of Wall Street, rising corporate profits, and banks' hoarding of cash, much of it from taxpayers, as sign of an economic recovery. However, in the real economy, in which most Americans live, the recession is not over. Rising unemployment, business failures, bankruptcies, and foreclosures are still hammering Main Street. This health care bill continues the redistribution of wealth to Wall Street at the expense of America's manufacturing and service economies, which suffer from costs other countries do not have to bear, especially the cost of health care. Notwithstanding the fate of H.R. 3962, America will someday come to recognize the broad social and economic benefits of a not-for-profit, single-payer health care system, which is good for the American people and good for America's businesses, with, of course, the notable exceptions being insurance and pharmaceuticals. From Dennis Kucinich, in case anyone was wondering why he said no to the Affordable Health Care for America Act. It's really madness, isn't it? We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Phone number is 877-996-2556. According to U.S. press reports on Sunday, Obama has decided to send either 20, 30, or 40,000 troops, additional U.S. troops, to Afghanistan. Wow. McClatchy newspapers reported Saturday night that Obama has already settled on 34,000 troops, but was waiting to announce it until after briefing the other governments participating in the NATO occupation. And after completing a trip to Asia, Obama, now set for starting this week, I think Wednesday. McClatchy newspapers is citing, quote, administration and military officials, unquote. McClatchy identified the new military units to be deployed in Afghanistan as including three Army brigades from the 101st Airborne Division, the 10th Mountain Division, and a Marine Brigade. These forces, comprising 23,000 soldiers, would serve in combat and support roles. Another 7,000 troops would establish a new division headquarters in Kandahar. Another 4,000 military trainers would likely be sent as well. The details could still change, according to McClatchy newspapers, their sources. And everything would not be finalized until a NATO meeting November 23rd. You know it's going to happen. You know it is. Barack Obama could no more stand up to the military-industrial complex than any president since Kennedy. I think the last one to really do it was Truman, and then Eisenhower identified it as a force for evil in this country. And no president since has been able to take a stand and say no. And the ones that have tried have been crucified or murdered. Crucified politically or murdered. Jesus, God. Interesting little blog here by Jamal Dejani. This is at Link TV's website, linktv.org. He writes, seven messages and counting on my voicemail from different Bay Area reporters, all wanting to know the Muslim community's reaction about the recent heinous killings of Nidal Malik Hassan. all wanting to know what had driven a 39-year-old Muslim to go on a killing rampage, murdering 13 people in Fort Hood, Texas. Someone said, quote, he had it all. He's an educated man. He's a doctor. Why did he do it? Well, apparently, Jamal writes, I fit the profile of someone who has these answers. I'm a Muslim Palestinian American, and I must know what one out of the 1.5 billion Muslims around the globe is thinking at any given time. Hey, Jamal, sorry to disturb you so early, but you know, the Hassan story is big, and I was wondering if you're willing to come for an interview and talk about how it feels being a Muslim and all. A television producer says to me on my cell while I was driving to work. I answered, how did you feel being a Christian with Timothy McVeigh and Adolf Hitler being Christians? Silence. I probably should not have said that. But there it is. I'm sick and tired of these kinds of questions from media outlets whenever some kooky Muslim decides to commit a random act of violence, or in this case, when a GI psychiatrist goes psycho. At the same time, I'm also sick and tired of self-appointed Muslim experts and spokespersons who jump at every miserable opportunity like this one to try to explain Islam. They say, Islam is a religion of peace. No, it's not. Not any more than Christianity is a religion of love. They're just religions. And what you do with them is all up to the believer. More people have died in the name of religion than in any other catastrophe or plague. Here is what I know about Hassan, Jamal writes. He was a disgruntled GI who wanted to leave the military for whatever reason, his conscience, his religion, or for personal reasons. He could have left peacefully. He could have quit and paid the price without hurting others, just like Muhammad Ali, who refused the draft to serve in Vietnam but did not feel the need to go on a killing rampage. Instead, he was stripped of his heavyweight title and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Hassan is a coward. Not only for committing this heinous act, but for counting on being killed or taking the gun on himself, leaving behind his family and the entire Muslim community to account for his despicable actions. Jamal Dajani, who is sick and tired of being asked about, you know, it's just like, you know, the black folk listening right now saying, going, that's right. How many times has something happened regarding a black person, and you've called up your black friend and said, George, listen, tell what's this about? And the black man or woman at the end of the phone is going, you know, may try to answer you because, you know, you're just trying to be a friend, even though you are really an ignorant white person where it concerns this stuff. And the black guy's just going, or the black woman's just going, all right, once again, I got to answer for, you know, millions of black people. Oh, Christ. Oh, well. Army Chief of Staff George Casey told CNN on Sunday, in the wake of this massacre, Army Command is starting to express concerns about a potential backlash against Muslim members of the military. Already you've got these vermin on Fox News and right-wingers calling for a purge of Muslim people out of the U.S. military. Son of a bitch. It's getting bizarre. Anyway, Chief of Staff, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey told CNN on Sunday that the last thing he would like to see result from this tragedy is anti-Muslim activity or the loss of diversity in military ranks. He says, we have to be careful because we can't jump to conclusions now based on little snippets of information that come out. Frankly, I am worried, Casey said. Not worried, but I'm concerned. You're worried, General. That this increased speculation could cause a backlash against some of our Muslim soldiers, and I've asked our Army leaders to be on the lookout for that. It'd be a shame if our diversity became a casualty as well. Asked whether he thought there was discrimination against Muslims in the military before the Fort Hood incident, he replied, no, I don't think so. Really? So, the reports by Muslim members of the military about this kind of harassment, General, is just a lie. The other thing about Casey, he's been complaining about the stop loss for soldiers. Stop loss activity, that's keeping people in the military past what they signed up for. Long tours of duty in Afghanistan, Iraq, and not enough dwell time at home between tours. Ever since he became Army Chief of Staff, now he thinks, apparently he's signed on to the more troops in Afghanistan craziness. And as Sharon, our military affairs correspondent, writes, this will ensure more PTSD, more suicides, murders, broken families, drug addiction for our soldiers. Sharon writes, I'm beginning to think General Casey isn't sincere about helping our soldiers and repairing our broken army. So Casey's on board now for more soldiers in Afghanistan. We'll be right back. Easy question. Planes hit the towers in the Pentagon, killing those the government wasn't dependent on. It's easy to control the scared, so they keep us in fear. We're their favorite Middle Eastern demon named Bin Laden this year. Butch disguises blood, thus his patriotism, convincing the living to love operations and to get them. But when he realized we don't support their attacks, they needed something to distract. Anthrax. This further demonizes Afghanis, so Americans cheer while we kill their innocent families. And what better place to start a war? To build a pipeline to get the oil that they had wanted before.
You're listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
One past the hour, Sharon also sent this from the Wall Street Journal. More suicides. 16 more American soldiers killed themselves in October in the U.S. and on duty overseas. An unusually high monthly toll, the Wall Street Journal reports, that is fueling concerns about the mental health of the nation's military personnel after more than 8 years of continuous warfare. The Army's top generals worry that surging tens of thousands more troops into Afghanistan could increase the strain felt by many military personnel after years of repeated deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. So far, with the October suicides, that means so far this year, 134 active duty soldiers have committed suicide. Jesus Christ. And then there's this. Taliban-led insurgents in Afghanistan have devised ways to cripple and even destroy the expensive armored vehicles that offer U.S. forces the best protection against roadside bombs that we have by using increasingly large explosive charges and rocket-propelled grenades, according to U.S. soldiers and defense officials. At least 8 American troops have been killed in attacks on so-called mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, or MRAPs. The insurgents' success in attacking the hulking machines, which can cost as much as $1 million apiece. Jesus Christ. $1 million. Underscores the insurgents' ability to counter the advanced hardware that the U.S. military and its allies are deploying. This is a horrific situation. It is astonishing to me that Barack Obama... No, it's not astonishing. It's surprising to me that Barack Obama is going to do exactly what a Republican president would have done, exactly what Bush, McCain, I'll just name one. This is Obama's war now. He has the ability to stop it. It's not Obama's economy. It's Obama's health care, health insurance reform, and it's Obama's war in Afghanistan. He has the power to stop this, but I think he understands that if he tries, as Kennedy tried to stop the Vietnam War, that he, the President of the United States, will be shot. I think he understands that. So here we are. You disagree with that? You think Obama is hasn't thought about that at all? All right, we're going to take some calls, 877-996-2556. And Nan is in St. Louis. Hi, Nan.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Hey, because I'm sure you're a quadrillion percent not corporate-owned, and I use that number because until the Prairie Tooth carry derivative hits, I don't know a bigger number. But Do you know what the grandfather clause is in H.R. 3962?
I do not.
Okay. That is like the hugest lie of omission that if you list, I'm so glad you played Dennis Kucinich because he alludes to it, and after you know what it is, you'll understand what he's saying. But what it is it allows the employer who now provides insurance coverage, they are not required to meet any level of minimal care that's in this bill. They are grandfathered out of it. And to understand better that whole thing, I remembered that I had read this, and I found it again.
Wait, let me ask you. The employers are not required, you said minimal care. You mean minimal insurance?
No. All of the essence of the entire health care bill, they are going to be exempt from if they already provide insurance. That is capitation, rescission, what's the other big one? I'm having a mental pause.
I have no idea, but I get the, I understand what you're saying.
Pre-existing conditions. Right. Okay. They don't have to abide by any of those requirements, and there's supposed to be a minimum level of care that they have to provide.
Well, now wait, I'm not understanding again. Are you talking about the insurance companies or the employer? You're saying employer.
The insurance plan that the employer offers.
Okay,
have to purchase that. You cannot.
Right.
You cannot go outside this.
Right. Employer. So it's the insurance company you're referring to. Hold on a minute. Let me put you on hold a second, and we'll come back after this break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone.
Gentle into that good night. Rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Oh, yeah. 25 before the hour, we were talking with Nan in St. Louis. All right, so
let me make this easier for you, and let me read you these three sentences because it'll explain it a lot better than I can. There is no real requirement for employers to provide any kind of minimal level of care. On the contrary, employers who currently offer subpar coverage will have their plans protected by a grandfather clause. This grandfather clause has potentially wide-ranging consequences. This little glitch is the essence of the health care reform effort. Veteran legislators speak of this horrific loophole as if it were an accident, something that just sort of happened. Okay, that is in Matt Taibbi's article from 2 months ago, in September 3rd of 2009. And I'd kind of forgotten about it, but I remembered the grandfather clause thing. So last night when I was reading the summary of 3962, the grandfather clause is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it took a while for me to remember where I saw it, so I did. Then I tried to find the context of what the grandfather clause was. Well, it's not in the definition of it isn't in the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Senate Health Committee bill. And if you go to the C-SPAN archives, the final markup of the Health Committee bill, the final 30 minutes of that, which was at 1:30 in the morning, like on a Saturday, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon offered his amendment, to which John Kerry and Baucus shot down. And they didn't even mince any words. They both said, the insurance industry, Raytheon, the pharmaceutical industry do not want this in the bill, and it's not going to be in the bill. So after his 30-minute outrage of how could they do this to the American people, he withdrew it and didn't even make them vote on it.
Well, so,
that's where you can verify it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, Nan. I appreciate your reporting that. And frankly, I think you should be in the House because you sure as hell know a lot more about this stuff than I do, or
I'm
average person.
Because I'm in the medical profession.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that's really horrible is the STUPAC amendment, which literally what that does is it takes any provisions of any insurance policy, not just the ones in the exchange for, you know, reproductive care for women, right to privacy, will be removed from all insurance policies because of the little thing about, you know, the federal, there cannot be federal funds. Well, anybody who makes up to $60,000 is going to be given a subsidy to buy their insurance, which means if the insurance industry wants that money, they have to remove that provision from all policies, not just people going into the exchange. Unless you're a company that only has employees that make over $60,000.
It's astonishing what is being denied to people through this perverted, lousy health care.
Well, this is an Insurance Industry Enslavement Act. I mean, literally. It's horrific.
Nan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I appreciate you checking in. Nan is absolutely right, of course. You know, this is a terrible joke on us. Haven't you had enough of this? Really? I mean, enough discussion, enough hearing about it, enough of realizing how we are once again being delivered into the hands of corporate America, this time the health insurance industry. Aren't you sick of the discussion about Afghanistan? Aren't you sick about talking about the unemployment picture that just keeps getting worse and worse? And it's going to continue, by the way. Don't think that the employment picture is going to improve. It's not. It's going to get much, much worse. Back in the golden days of Ronald Reagan, unemployment was 10.8%. We're at, what, 10.2? 10.3? No, we have a long way to fall. Regarding Afghanistan, Michael writes, just asking the obvious question. If the National Security Council Brzezinski plan, created during the Carter administration, to lure the Soviets into Afghanistan was to, quote, give them their own Vietnam, end quote, which was Brzezinski's idea, and thereby bring down the Soviet Union, which it succeeded at doing, What else but an extraordinary degree of hubris makes us think that escalating in Afghanistan can't do the same thing to us? Hello? Hello? Michael and Roswell. Yeah, the whole suckering the Soviet Union into Afghanistan was deliberately aided and abetted and promoted by Brzezinski, Mika's dad, on Morning Joe, and Carter. I mean, the whole thing. And I think some Russian generals eventually acknowledged that by referring to it as their Vietnam. Okay, if that was the case then, what's the difference now? One doesn't exist. Think about the names that will be on the monument for the Afghan-Iraq American dead. I wonder who's going to design that one. And think also that of the 58,000 names on the Vietnam Memorial Wall, about 30,000 of those, none of them should have been there, but about 30,000 came about after Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and, who was it, Lê Duc Tho, tried to negotiate the size and shape of the table at the so-called Paris peace talks or something like that. I don't know. I've got that all garbled. But I do know that the war was prolonged with the inevitable conclusion that we are going to lose it, to the point that 30,000 American names are on that wall that need to have been there, and God only knows how many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of wounded Americans are still dealing with what happened in Southeast Asia. And here we go again. This is madness. I mean, Jesus God, it's just insane. Steve is in Austin, Texas. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, you just took all the wind right out of my sails. Regarding General Casey and what Sharon had to say, I believe Sharon kind of understates things a bit.
Sharon, you know, the reason Sharon is my military affairs correspondent, she has a deep and abiding respect for the military. I don't think Sharon was in the service, but so many of her male relatives were, and she sees the military for its moments of honor. And there have been moments of honor. She sees the military for its moments of sacrifice. And there have been those moments. And she also sees the military now as something that has been and is being used, at the whim of corporate America, and it drives her crazy.
It infuriates her. It's been corrupted. What we've seen in Fort Hood last week is one of many leaks in the dam that's holding back once all these young people and old people come back from there. It's very scary, and there aren't enough fingers to poke their holes, poke their fingers in all the holes that are going to come up.
And no, like, there isn't.
It's 40 years ago, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, our older children and our grandchildren, are perhaps going to see these guys from Iraq and Afghanistan, on corners with signs and boxes, or perhaps a little more aggressive. I don't know. It's really, really scary about the mental health of all these people that are on fourth and fifth deployments.
Yeah, this is madness. At least in Vietnam, as horrible as Vietnam was, you knew you had a year.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew when the year was over, if you could survive, you went home. That was the end of it. End of story. Goodbye. Thanks for all the fish. I'm out of here.
Right. Well, it was in World War II. It was, 6 months?
Well,
something like that, and then you got time behind the lines, or at least
It got to the point in World War II where a lot of people were in for the duration, but that was that was a world war, and there was no out. I mean, it was a death struggle.
But we've already doubled it.
Yeah,
as far as duration, it's total insanity.
It is.
It's like 10, 15 years, 20 years down the road, is Rumsfeld going to come forth like McNamara and say, oh, geez, I'm sorry, I made a bad mistake? Or is Robert Gates going to step up and say, oh, geez, you know, we didn't know?
Yeah, well, you got to wonder about that. I got to leave there. Steve, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. We'll be right back. You got the wrong Peter. For the hour, thanks to our little group here, Sharon Gordy, Bruce Enberg, Ben Birch, Kate Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Kathy Bay, who's the executive producer. Merrily is in Berkeley, California. Is it Merrily?
Yeah, I like that better than my real name. Merrily sounds good to me. Oh, thanks for your show. You're a voice in the wilderness. I love your show.
Well, thank you very much. It's very
You're
kind.
Welcome. My theory is that these guys, generals, military men, politicians, all of them, are super experts at three-card Molly. They play a geopolitical three-card Molly. They draw your attention over here and they pass some rotten bills or do something totally against the American people over there. And you look over there and they then switch the walnuts to... and the peas, you know, so you can never really know what's going on.
I think you mean three-card Monty.
Well, we call it three-card Molly out here.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. But in any case, I think that Fort Hood thing, that man was a Manchurian candidate.
You think?
Sure. Comes out of the psychiatric division of the U.S. military.
Uh-huh.
That's what we call mind control.
Yeah.
And he... pulled off a horrendous deal like only a real sleeper could. And there's so many mysteries around. What happened to the two guys that were there that were spirited away before anybody showed up? And just all kinds of messy details in this three-card.
So,
I'll say Monty for your sake.
So here we go again with another suspicious, under the best of circumstances, action that kills people and focuses.
And then he was dead for 6 hours, and then he comes back to life. This is all so part of this horrendous show that they give us when they want us to be paying attention to Texas. And things are going on in other parts of the world that we should be really focused on. So it's all just part of their geopolitical three-card Monty, as you put it.
I think you may be onto something, Marilyn. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, I appreciate you checking in. I don't know. I'm curious too. Now that Marilyn, really, I just left the N off her name inadvertently. I'm curious too. What happened to? I mean, was it just, you know, in the moment of something horrible like this happening, there'll be reports two other people were also involved in the shooting, taken to the hospital or whatever. You hear those reports at first, and then when things start to, I hate to say calm down, but I don't know how else to put it. Things start to sort themselves out or calm down. And everybody's dead or dying, who's going to be dead or dying, and the wounded are laying on the ground, and the shooting is stopped. And then the people whose job it is to piece together what exactly happened begin their peace work. But there remains those questions that were raised in the horrible fire of that moment of when the shooting is going on, when the screaming is going on, when there's nothing but mass confusion. Maybe there weren't two other perpetrators. Maybe not. Maybe it is just as it's being presented now. Guy goes nuts for whatever reason. I know the right wing in this country wants to paint him as a military U.S. military equivalent of a suicide bomber. I'm reading that now. He intended to be killed. I don't know. Manchurian candidate? Very, very possibly. On the other hand, maybe just somebody who was so screwed up, inside his own mind, his own head, his own life. You know, he's a Muslim and he understands what is being said about Muslims in this country. He's in the United States military where he's an officer, and that must set up a horrendous contradiction inside his own head. Then he finds out he's going to be deployed to a war zone where his comrades in uniform are killing Muslims, and his job is to counsel people who have been in war zones where the target is Muslims. I mean, how do you not snap? So, was he a so-called Manchurian candidate? Was he a jihadist, suicide killer? Was he an American citizen, military officer who went nuts with all the pressure? I don't mean went nuts. I mean just had a complete break, however momentary it was, with reality because of who he is, was, and what he was being asked to do. I mean, who knows? I damn sure don't. I just know that if we did not have a military like this, if we did not have repeated deployments into two combat zones by an ever-shrinking number of people who are doing this, being sent off to kill or be killed, wounded and PTSD'd and psychologically disturbed for the rest of their lives. Jesus, God, what is it about us that is just so sick in this society? What is it about our militarism and our capitalism that is just, I don't know, it's like a junkie. We just keep jamming the goddamn heroin needle right into our veins, don't we? We just keep doing it over and over again. We know what happens to all junkies if they don't stop. Yeah, that's right. They die. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. Individual results.